Welcome to Wisdom Rebellion, where we are figuring out how to improve our health, relationships, and family life with the help of the world's leading experts in how we get there, one challenging conversation at a time. Today, we are joined by Kat Boyd, a distinguished naturopath and nutritional therapist who specializes in natural fertility. With over 25 years of experience in the allied health professions and a focus on fertility for the past 15 years, Kat brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to her field. Renowned as a natural fertility specialist, she supports couples on their journey to parenthood, especially those facing challenges such as miscarriage or unsuccessful IVF treatments. Kat holds memberships in several widely recognized organizations, including the Association of Naturopathic Practitioners, General Naturopathic Council, and the British Fertility Society. Kat's personal experiences with polycystic ovarian syndrome, overcoming miscarriage to become a mother at the age of 38, have fueled her passion to help others achieve their dreams of parenthood. Based in London, she supports couples globally. Kat employs a holistic approach to fertility that integrates mindset, nutrition, herbal, and lifestyle medicine. On today's episode, we discuss the misconceptions about fertility, the importance of understanding the fertility window, the success rates and limitations of reproductive technologies, the significance of preconception care, as well as testing of hormones and nutritional deficiencies when trying for a family. We have explored so many aspects of fertility, including the often overlooked role of men, personalized fertility care, optimal diet and nutrition, the risks and limitations of egg freezing, and the side effects of fertility treatments. If you've listened to my podcast before, you know I'm concerned about the skyrocketing rates of unplanned childlessness, and this conversation is aimed at those who might be struggling with infertility, whether due to the medical conditions or age. I have had a bumpy road with having family in my mid-30s onwards, so I know it can be a tough journey, but there is hope. The impact of lifestyle choices such as diet, exercise, cold exposure, and stress management on fertility is huge. And this conversation is a deep dive into the natural fertility. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Kat Boyd. What are some of the things that people frequently get wrong when it comes to the fertility?
There are so many things that people get wrong about fertility. I can't choose just one. If I were to choose just one, it would be believing that fertility is going to work for them when they expect it will. What I find is that a lot of people might have, you know, when you grow up and you're like, oh, when I'm 30, I'm going to be married and I'm going to have two children, you know, and then by the time they get to 30, they realize that they're still building their career. They've still haven't found Mr. Right. They're wasting their time with Mr. Right now. And then when they are ready to have a baby, they then have a suck it and see approach, and they're not knowledgeable enough about their menstrual cycle. They're not knowledgeable enough about the idea of preconception care, and what you put in to preparing for a baby will result in a healthy pregnancy, a fast pregnancy, and most important, a beautiful, healthy baby.
I think it's interesting. Something came to me when you were talking about it. And when even I was at school, I don't remember anyone ever telling us that fertility doesn't just happen like a next day Amazon delivery. It can take months or years sometimes to actually get pregnant. The presumption, whether unspoken, was always, always, always protect yourself because you can get pregnant anytime.
Yes. The reason for that is when you are 16 or 17, the chances of you getting pregnant each month, if you were to have unprotected sex, are huge. And so the government and the school system has, you know, they want to protect young people when they're young, irresponsible, from teenage pregnancies. So we're all told, if you look at a penis, you're going to get pregnant. And, you know, the fear around it, you know, for instance, and I've only got statistics from a 25-year-old, and she will have a 25% chance per month of getting pregnant. And if you contrast that to a 40-year-old, that's a less than 5% chance per month of getting pregnant.
Wow.
So can you see why we're not told that at school? The other issue is, and I've been involved in fertility education for 10-year-old girls through a lovely project called My Fertility Matters. It's a German program, but it's been rolled out in the UK. When we were trying to put this forward, and even the point of fertility education for children, young children, the backlash that we get from the powers that be about promoting fertility to young people, because it conflicts completely with what their goal is, which is not to have people falling pregnant. So if you start telling young girls, do you know what, if you're not, it's really hard to get pregnant when you're older, it changes the game and changes the, you know, their motivation to protect themselves, and perhaps there'll be more underage pregnancies. So that's the reason. And do you know what? The most common phrase I get, well, I get two very common phrases from my clients. One is, I wish I knew about you sooner. And the other is, why don't they teach us this in school?
Yeah. I've spoken to quite a few people, and the I wish that they taught us more of this at school came up a ton. And I suppose you are in a little bit of the difficult situation, right? Because I'm not here to promote teenage pregnancies. You know, it is hard having a baby and trying to sort of carry on with life, especially if you're a teenager. You know, biologically speaking, you might be the most prime for your childbearing years, but psychologically speaking, in terms of the preparedness for like adult life, it's not quite there. And I think the way that we structure our entire education, things like that, your life is planned. It's school education up to about 25. Then you've got about 5 years, maybe growing your career, boom, you're already 30. But the statistic that I found out from Stephen Jay Show, he made a documentary called Birth Gap, is that currently in the West, 50% of women will go into their 30s without becoming a mothers. And then out of those 50%, at least 50% more will never actually have children. His current estimation for the States is about 35% of all women will end up not having kids, and only about 10% of those are by choice rather than by circumstance. So it is difficult, because in current life, as we are teaching it to young women, by the time we make the space for family building, you're already past your fertility window. So let's actually talk about the fertility window, because I, again, was one of these people that just didn't know about it.
So women are born with all of their eggs, unlike a man who has the ability to create sperm every single second. So with women's fertility, as we, you know, would have evolved from history, we would have had children very, very young. And by the time we would be, say, 35 years old, we probably would have had around 10 to 15 children. With the advent of the contraception, of course, we've been able to delay that to get our careers and find the right man and get all our ducks in a row, so to speak. However, what that's meant is, by the time we do that, we're, you know, in our 30s or mid-30s, and that coincides with the time when a woman's reproductive potential drastically declines. So I mentioned before that when you're 25, you've got a 25% chance of conceiving each month. And when you're more like 40, you've got less than 5% chance. So somewhere in there, what happens is your fertility, it comes along, and then it starts to fall down. But the horrible technical term that's used all the time is it falls off a cliff, which is, you know, really a horrible way to think about it. And that starts to happen I think everyone's got this 35 number in their head, but it really starts to happen in the early 30s. And when you hit 35, that's when it really goes quite sharply. And not everybody is the same. Yes, there can be 45-year-olds that have children, and you know, but generally, statistically, that's generally what happens to women. And that's to do with egg numbers, but also egg quality. And that's the real issue with trying to get pregnant when you're older. It's the egg quality. And the other thing that people don't really think about with pregnancy is once you are pregnant, like the first time you're pregnant, it's like, yay, I'm pregnant. And you imagine like you're going to have a baby in 9 months. But it's really hard to actually have a baby. And the topic of miscarriage is also, you know, something that isn't talked about as much. It's starting to be, and I hope it's going to be the resurgence, like the menopause movement has been in the past couple of years, where people start talking about miscarriage. Because if you think, oh, I'm going to have a baby when I'm, you know, 35, and lo and behold, you get pregnant after 12 months of trying, perhaps, and then you get into 3 months, and then you have a miscarriage, and then you start all again. There's so many spanners in the works that come into it when we're talking about fertility, but that's essentially what happens with successful conception attempts. As you get older, it just gets harder, and the chance of loss gets a lot higher as well.
Okay, let's play the devil's advocate for the culture and the story of fertility that we've been perhaps told for the last coming up to, I would say, about 30-40 years. We now have got technologies that can help us, you know, get pregnant and potentially carry the baby into our late 30s, even 40s. We've seen newspaper stories about mid 40s and late 40 women carrying babies. So why would that not be the case for, you know, Susan down the pub?
Yes, the media has a lot to hold themselves responsible for with this misinformation. What the Hollywood celebrity pregnancy, and you know, I'm not speaking about anyone in particular, but what they don't share is, where did the egg come from? And if you're a 47-year-old or 50-year-old woman who has had a successful pregnancy, did the egg come from her? And that's the missing piece of information, and it's completely their private information as well. Nobody has any right to, you know, to ask that question. But that's essentially where it happens. And also, if Susan down the pub doesn't have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds to pay for 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 rounds of IVF, which is not unheard of when you're trying to have a baby when you're that old.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about reproductive technologies and how successful they actually are at delivering babies.
I think they can be incredibly beneficial in having babies, but I think we all have to have realistic expectations of their success rate. And I think any honorable IVF clinic will, you know, we'll give you the statistics on how things will work out for you. There's also the, you know, there's plenty of resources online that will talk about that. But it's about when you get to that stage, you're so desperate, you will do anything. And, you know, if only you have a 5% chance, well, you'll still take that 5% chance, because maybe without it, you've got a 0% chance.
When you said 5%, is that the sort of the rate at which you can expect a successful live birth after the IVF? Because if I remember rightly, the rates of pregnancy are higher with the IVF, but the rates of live births are drastically lower than the actual rates of pregnancy. And I'm going to butcher the statistic, but in my head, I remember that it's about 10%, maybe 7%. Do you know what that is, like the actual rate of live births?
Yeah, I would always try and remember facts with relation to live birth, because that's all that matters. But that is exactly what you need to do when you if you were looking at an IVF clinic, is not be is actually go in with that knowledge that are they talking pregnancies or live births, because who cares how many pregnancies you have if you don't have a baby. So the success rate, you know, it really depends how old you were or how old your eggs are, if we're talking about egg freezing. So if you're a woman, say at 35, you'd expect a 32% chance of having a successful IVF.
32%.
Yes, that's at best. Yeah. Most women age of IVF are around about 36, the average age, and you'd expect for her about a 25% chance, for a 38 to 39 year old a 19% chance, and 5% chance for 43 to 44 year old, which is exactly the same as the chances of a natural pregnancy.
Wow, I did not know that. I thought that IVF does give you like that little bit of the boost in terms of your chances. Wow.
What it does, it helps put the sperm and the egg together. And of course, with IVF, it's not just about a sperm issue, an egg issue. It could be a sperm issue. So sometimes I'll get some clients, and of course, I work in natural fertility. It's all about improving egg and sperm health for the optimal health of a baby, as well as improving implantation chances, so making sure that your uterus is nice and healthy to implant as well. However, from time to time, I do get people that come in, and she might be in her 40s, and you know, you can do tests and find out how many eggs are coming through in the next few months. It's called an antral follicle count test. And if I find that that's quite low, and I find, you know, and of course we're only working, I work with people on quality, so we'd be improving those three eggs coming through for optimal chances. However, when you find the man has problems, and this is going to be huge, the decline in men's fertility is worse than you describe childlessness for women, and. So what IVF can do is, if there's, you know, and I can work on helping sperm, but it will take 3 to 6 months to improve, you know, all the sperm parameters. You can take a man that's basically been told he's infertile, and you can turn that around within 6 months with the right support. However, when you've got a 43 or 42 year old woman, she hasn't got time to wait 6 months for that sperm to be better.
Improved.
Mm. So with the, you know, with reproductive technology, it's a wonderful thing because you can then get the sperm, like one good sperm out of a 20 million count, perhaps, one good sperm to fertilize that egg. Where if they were trying naturally, because there's a you know, two issues, his issue and her issue, the chances of you know, a natural is virtually impossible. And that's where reproductive technology really can really help people.
There are some really interesting hypotheses, I think, at this stage about men's plummeting infertility. The one that I find particularly interesting is due to the amount of free-flowing estrogen in our water supplies, for example. And I think, if I remember rightly, the idea is that because so many women are on the pill, the amount of estrogen that gets into the water systems that can't be filtered out very easily affects men badly. They don't need estrogen for anything, apparently. And I don't think that that's been sort of proven, but it's definitely one of the hypotheses around on like plummeting fertility rates for men. And I think the one sort of difficult thing about men as well is they do fall between the gaps in terms of looking at the percentage of, for example, men that will become fathers, simply because they're actually more tricky to measure. For women, like, you know, up to 50, you pretty much know how many children she's going to have. For a man, yes, it's not as often that it happens, but a 60-year-old man can still father children. And potentially he could have, you know, children in three different counties or countries for a woman, technically, more often, she will have her children around her. So I think it's just the measurement for the men is a little bit more difficult, which is why they sort of slip through the net. So the really interesting leaflet, I suppose, or a snippet of like a little table that I found produced by one of the British associations, can't remember which one, but I'll link to it, shows when do you need to start trying for, if you want, for example, one to have one child, two children, three children, and I think it goes up to three. And if you want to have over 90% chance of having three children, you need to start. Again, I might butcher it, but I will link it and I'll show it on the video as well. I think it's 23. The age is 23. And you will have 90% chance that you will have three kids. That's early. And then the later you start, your chances just keep going down and down and down. And I think your chance, no, I can't remember, so I won't even say it, but on the graph, you will be able to see what the chance of having three kids is for a woman that starts in her 30s. Very, very, very low. And I don't think that we have got an answer as a society. But clearly, there are people like you that work with fertility. So women, sooner than later, will wake up to the fact that they might have left it a little bit too late, that they might want to have a bigger family. What are their options, realistically speaking? And how long does it even take to improve your chances?
So, as I said before, women are born with all of their eggs, and they go through this. They have to go through two extra stages of growth to become ready for ovulation and fertilization to become a baby. And that whole process takes 120 days, and that's known as the preconception period. So, you need at least 120 days to prepare. And ideally, you need another 120 days prior to that to sort out your nutritional deficiencies, to learn about your fertility, to understand what your menstrual cycle is doing, to learn about the signs and symptoms of fertility, such as your cervical mucus, taking your temperature, understanding what your cycle is doing, if there are any problems with your cycle, to have some time to sort that out. And, you know, for someone with polycystic ovaries, for instance, that's not going to just be 3 months. That's going to be, it could be 3 years. So it really depends what your period's like, and actually knowing what's going on in your body as soon as possible. So that would be, absolutely key advice would be to, you know, at any age, get your hormones checked. Especially if you've got some issues with your menstrual cycle, if it's painful or if it's not regular, and you know, textbook regular is 28 days, it can be a few days either side of that. Knowing when your ovulation is when you release your egg somewhere in the middle of the cycle, and again, that's even complex to work out from a standardized point of view. It really comes down to the woman and her learning her body, and that's certainly what I do with my clients. I teach them about natural fertility, understanding, you know, what their hormones are doing, what effects they're having on their body, so that when it comes time that they are ready, or they have, you know, the green light from their partner to have a baby, that everything's organized. You've got your hormones right, your nutrition's right, you know, you've got all the right building blocks for your baby. Because so babies are actually built within 12 weeks of being of conception. And I think that's a lot of people don't know that as well. They think, oh, when you're pregnant, your baby's built the whole time that you're pregnant, but it actually isn't. It's the first 12 weeks. So what resources you've got in your body before that time, which is why the preconception period's important, actually put down the building blocks for your baby. And I say this, everything I say about a woman, I also mean for a man as well. So, you know, you're only, as a woman, you're only contributing 50% of the DNA of your child. The other half obviously comes from the father.
Okay. You mentioned the checking your hormones. Is that, you know, going to the doctors, or is it one of these prick blood tests that are now commercially available? Like, are they the same thing, like what you get at the fertility clinics?
Quite honestly, I would avoid, if possible, the NHS in your fertility journey, because if you're too old, i.e. above 40, you'll be laughed at and told, oh, well, you know, you just won't be given, you won't be given the respect you deserve. And that often puts people in a very negative emotional space. If you're too young, you'll be told you're too young. Just wait some time. And for the sake of, you know, £150, and I appreciate not everybody's got that, but for the sake of £150, you can, yes, use those finger prick places and get your day two or three blood tests done. And that means the third day, second or third day of your menstrual cycle. And you count the first day as to when you have some like proper blood coming through. It's not that important whether it's day two or three or even four, just in that beginning phase of your menstrual cycle is the key. And what that will tell you is there's a key hormone called FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, and that's the key one you want to be looking at, particularly if you're a bit older. And for optimal fertility, you want that to be under 10. And that's the one that raises as you're losing your fertility potential. So women that are going through perimenopause or heading towards menopause, FSH goes really high, like in the 20s, even 30s or 40s. And the reason is it comes from your pituitary gland in your brain. And what that does, it acts on your ovaries. It sends a hormone messenger to, which is called FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, does what it says on the tin, sends a message to your ovaries to say, start growing eggs. Start growing eggs. As the eggs grow, they produce estrogen, which is another hormone that would be checked in these tests. So estrogen then starts growing, starts being produced in the body, and then the high estrogen kicks off another hormone called luteinizing hormone, LH. And if anybody is trying to conceive, you know those little strips that you pee on, you're looking for the LH. And LH surges when there's enough estrogen. And that's what pops the egg out of the follicle, and that's how ovulation happens. So that's the first beginning, the beginning phase of a cycle, and that's called the follicular phase because the follicle is growing. And then after that, you have the luteal phase, which is after the luteinizing hormone's been present. The follicle then changes into the progesterone-producing part, which is called the corpus luteum, and that keeps your uterine lining intact for the next 2 weeks, and then if you are pregnant and beyond until you give birth, essentially. So that they're the hormones that get checked.
If you are pregnant, you then wee on even more sticks, and then finally you will get a double line or a cross or whatever.
But yes.
For the women that have been trying for babies, they pee on a lot of sticks throughout the period of the month.
Yes. Well, you see, when you learn natural fertility awareness, essentially, just like a hen would take would sit on her eggs to keep them warm, a woman's body temperature rises after she's released her egg, and it'll stay risen. And that's, in fact, how I found out I was pregnant with my son. My body temperature had stayed high for 17 days. And I'm like, this isn't right, because the second phase of your cycle can't be any longer than 15, 16 days. And it was like, 17 days. And it was New Year's Eve and I was in New Orleans. I was certainly ready to go out and have a glass of champagne or something. And then I thought, I just better do a test. And I did. And it was positive. And and I didn't need to do the test, but my body temperature told me that I was pregnant. And so, you know, women don't need to do tests. They just, you know, you can save a lot of money just by measuring your temperature.
It is fascinating, the tracking the basal body temperature. What you were saying about, you know, just a pregnancy doesn't mean a baby. It's tough. It's tough, but it happens, and obviously the risk just keeps going up the older you get. Earlier on, when you were talking about the building blocks of a new life, essentially. What building blocks are we talking about? Because we know that folic acid is needed for the healthy growth of the baby. What else are those building blocks that are necessary?
So I'll correct you on folic acid, and I would never use folic acid with anybody because it's synthetic and the body doesn't necessarily recognize it. You're much better off using folinic acid or sometimes methyl tetrahydrofolate. So folic acid's very outdated, but you know, most people know that because that's what most doctors know. So really, and you get that from spinach. Nice organic spinach once or twice a day, you'll get what you need, and some. So you know, there are so many building blocks you need. So from calcium to help implantation, to help build bones throughout a pregnancy, from magnesium for cellular energy, from depending how old you are, depending on whether you need help to give energy to your mitochondria, because that will improve your genetic quality and the ability for fertilization to happen. We can talk protein. Protein essentially is the literal building block of your human and your placenta. You need iron. You need, name something, you need it.
Okay. So you need yeah. loads, basically.
You do need loads, but you see, it's not a one size fits all scenario. Like, yes, as humans, we need certain things in place to be able to have a healthy egg and have implantation happen and have a healthy baby. But people come with so many deficiencies. They might have, IBS, or they might suffer depression, or they might, you know, be low in vitamin D and have a bad menstrual cycle. There are so many different things that are at play in a human's body that there can never be a one size fits all approach, which is why, you know, sometimes just taking a Pregnacare or something like that just isn't going to be, it's not going to correct what you hope it will. It's sort of false hope. Mm-hmm. that you're covering your needs.
In terms of testing, for example, for deficiencies, what mm-hmm. what things would be best to do that? Is it just a blood test at the GP that you would be getting? Or again, do you need to go a little bit more specialist and some private clinics that do these?
Yeah, again, a GP will never test unless there's a problem, unless you've got a problem with your menstrual cycle and it's gone missing. They might then do your hormone testing. However, to get a vitamin D test, which is, you know, so important for your immune system, which is involved in implantation. It's so important for hormone balance, and for a female and male for sperm production as well. Yes, you can check that through a private blood test for around about £40 for vitamin D. Folate B12 is really important if you're following a vegan or vegetarian diet. Of course, they're really important to get those checked. And iron as well. GPs might do iron if you go and complain about tiredness, and they might do vitamin D if you complain that you've been really unwell lately. So it depends on the GP, but all of these things take time. For instance, I had a client whose wife had polycystic ovaries, and they're quite young. I mean, they're 32, but they feel they're quite young. And it turned out that in addition to her polycystic ovaries, he had a very, very, very low sperm count. And I found out that he was on some medication for his mental health, which he absolutely needed to be on. Some research into that medication showed that it interfered with his fertility potential. And so I would never suggest somebody come off the medication, but I sent him back to his GP to, you know, armed with the research and of this drug. And his sperm test that he'd done through me, and the GP said, oh, I better do a sperm test then. And that whole process from his GP just doing a sperm test and getting it back took 9 months.
9 months?
9 months. Going to the getting the GP appointment, getting the referral, getting the test time, getting the results back, getting an appointment with his GP to discuss the results, you know.
Wow.
9 months. And, you know, it probably wasn't all the GP and NHS's delay. It was probably, you know, partly down to him as well. However, 9 months on a fertility journey just for something that simple, you know, is crazy. So lo and behold, yes, he ended up on a different medication and his sperm has gone really well. We're still working on her polycystic ovaries. So watch this space. Yeah. But this is the spanner in the works that happens all the time with every fertility journey. And it's not just about a woman being 35 or 39. It's what in the hell is going on with the man. And men don't spend their nights on Instagram looking at fertility remedies. They're not reading the books. They're not taking the supplements. Men are busy with football, I guess, to be slightly stereotypical. And that's not all men. Some men are really wonderful. But generally, the fertility drive is led by the woman. And what we find is women come and they come to me and they've been taking, you know, there's a particular book that every woman reads and thinks it's going to resolve their fertility, and it doesn't. And
what's the book?
They then come to me. It's called It Starts with the Egg. Yeah. So it's a fabulous book to open people's eyes to the idea of preconception care, but there's a whole list of supplements people should take. And like I said before, it's not a matter of just take all the supplements and you'll get pregnant. Like it really needs to be bespoke and tailored. And I also say to people, if you had a tree in your garden and it fell down and broke your neighbor's house, would you then read a book on law and try and actually represent yourself in the legal battle of who should pay for this house? You wouldn't. You'd get a lawyer. Or if your tax needed doing, would you read a tax book and try and do it yourself? No, you wouldn't. You'd get an accountant. So why read a book when it comes to the most important thing you'll ever do, which is have a baby? So anyway, so I get people coming to me having done literally everything they think, and people think, oh, I've done everything, and that they haven't. And what they haven't done especially is they haven't had their partner's sperm checked. And so sometimes I get, you know, it's the first thing obviously I do, and I get, oh, look, you've got no sperm motility. If you haven't got sperm motility, the sperm can't get to the egg. You can't get pregnant. There are much deeper sperm tests you can do as well, such as, you know, what's the DNA in that sperm doing? If there's miscarriages, the DNA in the male sperm is a major contributing factor to miscarriage. So what do we need to do to improve the sperm, to improve the genetics? And, you know, all of this and a lot of what I see in my clinic is someone, oh, I just want to get pregnant. Well, no. You know, you want to get pregnant, you want to stay pregnant, you want to have a really clever, healthy, happy baby, because that's what it's all about. It's about the whole lifetime with that baby, not, oh, I just need to get pregnant. So that's where preparing is the important thing, laying down, you know, everything you possibly can to have a really strong egg, really strong sperm, and a beautiful uterus to grow it all in.
Okay, so we've got the sperm test that would be needed. We've got the hormone panel for the woman that would be needed. We've got deficiencies tests that would be needed. Let's talk diets, because there are probably 180 and counting diets currently out there. All promise the world. What is the diet that is required, for example, for an optimal fertility?
It's proven time and time and time and time again that a Mediterranean diet is best followed for fertility. So a Mediterranean diet means essentially some good quality fish. We can have an argument now about fish quality and mercury poisoning and, you know, the issue with our rivers and oceans and plastics and heavy metals, and I 100% agree. However, the research was done on the Mediterranean diet and included fish. Some red meat, not too much, once or twice a week. Good quality grains, lots of phytonutrients from fruits and vegetables. Not too many fruits, more vegetables. The green leafy vegetables are so important. Back to the folate that we were talking about before. Protein, having 2 grams of protein per day. Kilogram of body weight. Per kilogram of body weight. So that's quite a lot.
That's not easy to, it's not easy to get that much protein in. You need to be eating, again, fish, meat, eggs, legumes, I think, as well. They've got quite a lot, the Greek yogurt. What I found particularly when I was on a high-protein diet.
This is not a high-protein diet. This is just adequate protein to make hormones and build a baby.
Wow. I mean, I was full. So I had to eat, because I remember, I think at the time I was trying to get to 100, but I think I was calculating it at 1.6 gram per kilogram of weight, and I think I was trying to get to 96. And there were days where I was sat there, it's like, I don't even want to eat it, but I've still got like 20 grams of protein to get in today. Yeah.
A good way to do it is a high quality protein powder in a smoothie would be a good way to do that. So you pop your protein powder in along with some leafy greens, some blueberries, a little bit of, not too much banana, just a little bit. You could pop some seeds and nuts in there as well. And that's a really good way to supplement getting enough protein if you don't have enough from your diet.
But like, so for example, like for people that are trying to do it through normal diet, is it just when we start eating the adequate amount of protein because our previous diet was different? Is it just during the transition that we feel full, or is it genuinely filling the eating protein?
Well, look, if we didn't have things from grains like bread, and we didn't eat those, we would happily eat protein and we'd happily eat vegetables and we would feel perfect.
Okay.
If we didn't have big bowls of pasta and we didn't have calories in our drinks, all these additional things, if we went just back to, not necessarily the caveman diet. And in addition, it's not necessarily yes, follow a Mediterranean diet. If you can't get 2 grams of protein, that's fine. Just focus on protein, focus on vegetables, focus on, getting colors of the rainbow. I don't mean Skittles. I mean, colors of the rainbow. Aim for 10 different colors of foods a day, because they're going to give you everything a supplement can't, and that's food from nature. Shop organic if you can. Wash your foods. There's loads of pesticides, which is another contributing factor to fertility decline in men and sperm as well. One of the key things as well is intermittent fasting. Thinking about how you can actually improve men's sperm by intermittent fasting, because it's insulin that actually triggers the cell renewal process that can happen within somebody. So sugar is essentially sugar is a fertility killer, and we shouldn't really have any sugar in our diet whatsoever, unless it's coming from fruits, really. And that's where that's as nature intended. And we wouldn't have had 6 or 7 pieces of fruit a day. We would have, come across a lot less than that as we evolved. So 1 or 2 pieces of fruit a day, and the low sugar fruits like berries, blueberries are incredible for fertility. Walnuts, Brazil nuts are incredible. They've got lots of selenium in there. So it's just nice. I use the word slow. So seasonal food, local food, organic food, and whole foods. So nothing in a packet is the ultimate fertility diet. And I think part of the problem as well is we're also pushed for time, and we also have lost a lot of learning about food and how to prepare it as well. Be that because of our upbringings, or our mothers have been busy working, You know, I had a flatmate once who used to buy mashed potato. She'd literally buy mashed potato. I'm like, can't you just boil it and mash it? Oh, it's easier. I can just buy it mashed. Oh, okay. I had a friend, whose daughter, I'd said to her, oh, come around my house and don't forget to bring your toothbrush. You can clean my toilet with it as a joke. And she went, don't be ridiculous. The housekeeper cleans the toilet. It's like she'd never even seen her mum clean a toilet. You know, so the skills we're losing as women, this is, you know, off track of fertility, but the skills we're losing as women and men are as well, because everything's so convenient, but with convenience, there's obviously a cost. And, you know, when it comes down to it, we're getting further and further away from understanding what real food is and also how to prepare it. So mashed potato that comes in a plastic container, the plastic's going to be interrupting with your hormones, let alone the preservatives in there that have let it stay on the Sainsbury's shelf for 9 days, let alone, you know, the nutrition that's been lost because vitamins lose their power every single second after they're picked.
I think it's the state of our food industry and food quality can be seen by the percentage of your supermarket which is refrigerated. Or the percentage of your supermarket which is refrigerated, which basically means that it's usually things that are going off quickly, and the vegetable aisles. And I think in general, if you look at the average supermarket, there is less than 10% of normal real food there. 90% of what is in the supermarkets is processed one way or the other, and just further and further, further removed from the whole ingredients that they once were.
Absolutely. I'm Australian, and the supermarkets are set up a little differently here for this analogy, but it's essentially we, as a naturopath in Australia, would say shop on the outer aisles of your supermarket, because that's where the vegetables would be one side, your meats would be the other, and the back area would be something else, but avoid the middle aisles because that's where all the poison is. You know, you might get some nuts in the middle aisle, but otherwise.
I've heard that somewhere before, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing good comes from a packet.
Okay, so there was something that I wanted to go back to about freezing eggs. Now, I haven't been in the corporate industry for many years now, so I don't know whether that is in the UK already, but in the States, certainly the employers are offering women, you know, free egg freezing so they can put their fertility on hold and have the baby conveniently later. What do you think about that? Is it good? Is it bad?
Well, I think some careers, women will always put their career first. And if an employer is going to help fund that, well, that's fantastic, I guess. So with regards to egg freezing, you have to go into it with the knowledge that it's not the insurance policy that we're promised. And I think the problem is when people, particularly in corporate, and let's talk of, you know, the Facebooks and Googles of the world, offering that to their employees, and, you know, yes, fantastic. However, the crucial thing is you then go through life thinking, oh, I've got my eggs frozen. So then you don't prioritize meeting a man. You don't prioritize, you know, all the things you would if you didn't. And there's two big lies that have been told about egg freezing. And one is that, you know, just like IVF, you expect, oh, I've frozen my eggs, it's going to work out for me, which is absolutely untrue. Essentially, depending on how old you are when you freeze your eggs will impact how many eggs will thaw and how many eggs will be able to be made into embryos. And then how many embryos you get will also impact whether you actually end up with a live baby out of that. So just because you've got your eggs frozen doesn't mean you're going to end up with a baby. And in fact, that you might only even have a, you know, for instance, to have a 75% chance of having a baby, this is how many eggs you need. So if you're 34 years old, you need to have frozen 10 eggs. If you're 37, you need to have frozen 20 eggs. And if you're 42, you need to have frozen 61 eggs. One in five eggs, depending on the age, and that's the average, one in five eggs will fail the thaw process. And just because you have eggs, doesn't equal embryos. Yeah. So it depends how many eggs you have and how old you were when you froze them as to the chances of actually having a baby.
The numbers you're talking about seem extraordinarily high. We are not talking about, you know, Maltesers in a big sharing bag. I know that, you know, you've got a reserve of eggs, but bearing in mind only one of them actually develops every single cycle, it seems extraordinary high. Do you actually know what goes into the process of the egg retrieval?
Mm-hmm.
Because I assume that the woman has to be loaded with some serious doses of hormones.
Yes.
for her to get the amount of eggs that the fertility clinic would need for example, freezing processes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so it's a very similar situation to the beginning of IVF where, I'm not an embryologist, so I may not be 100% correct in this, so apologies if I'm messing it up anywhere. But from my understanding, it's very similar in that your own fertility is shut down. And there are different ways of doing it. You can work with your natural cycle as well. That does exist. But in that regard, you'd only get one egg per retrieval cycle. Through the medicated
route, it would be more expensive.
You would need to do a lot more, yeah. Through the medical route, essentially, you would shut down your normal hormonal functioning for egg development, and you would take your medications, and then you would what they would be looking for is to grow the eggs inside of your ovaries. And what happens in a normal cycle, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, is that each cycle there might be, and depending again on age, who you are, you know, lots of different things, but say for instance you might have 6 to 12 eggs in each ovary every month getting ready to become what I call the queen egg. So what happens is your body in its beauty and its wisdom recognizes the best genetic quality egg and then focuses its efforts through that FSH hormone, focuses its efforts on growing that egg to be the one that's going to be ovulated. And the others wither away. With IVF, instead of them withering away, stimulation, instead of them, what they're doing is they're trying to keep them and they're trying to get them all going. So this comes down to the quality of the egg as well. And then also when those eggs are fertilized in an IVF situation where the sperm's being met with the egg, then what you're left with is the blastocysts, which are the cells, and they will then grade those as well. So depending on, you know, it's like your school report card, oh, I've got, you know, some A's and some B's and some C's. And so depending on the quality of your embryo will also depend on the chances of that actually being a viable pregnancy and a baby. So there are so many things to consider in it all.
How much do we know about the health impacts of these technologies? Because I have seen some research, but I haven't delved into it enough to see perhaps the view for the opposition. But I have seen some research mentioned about, for example, that there seem to be, for example, a higher prevalence of certain conditions for people born through IVF, and that there is also some concerns about the hormonal impact on the woman for the treatments. And obviously you mentioned that sometimes we are not just talking about one course of IVF, we are talking about 6, 7, 8, and 10 sometimes. So we are talking a lot of powerful hormones. How much do we actually know about the downstream health effects on both the women that do take part in IVF, but then also the babies that are born through those technologies?
Yes, I wish I had an answer for you. Again, like yourself, I've seen the research, and particularly the early days where, I mean, I was told I'd need IVF and I'd never have a successful pregnancy. When I was told I would not be able to conceive without IVF, I was literally terrified, because at that point in time, I mean, I was 23 years old. Well, at that point in time, IVF seemed to be linked to, you know, cancers essentially, and also children with issues. And over the years, and we're talking more than 20 years now, it's sort of evened out that they're suggesting that the babies are okay, and that the medications don't necessarily contribute to that. So personally, I think the jury's still out, and you know, I don't think anybody plans to go into IVF, you know, as a choice. So sadly, you know, we're left at that point at the, you know, end of our fertility when we've exhausted our options. And, you know, when I was suffering my infertility, common thing I'd say is I'd cut my arms and legs off to have a baby, you know. So if I'm going to increase my chances of, you know, endometrial cancer by 5%, well, you know, so be it. Like, I want a baby, you know, and that's how we are as women that want babies, you know. Come hell or high water, doesn't matter, give me a baby. So so the research, you know, research is research, you know, you can have one piece that suggests this and the other piece that suggests it doesn't. So, but you know, the industry will have you believe that, you know, there's no risk to either. But I feel nothing is more powerful than the wisdom of your body, than the wisdom of your body to choose the best egg, and the wisdom of your body to allow the best sperm to fertilize your egg. And that's what your egg does. Mm. And so natural selection exists for a reason. And, you know, but not everybody has that privilege of having having that. And, you know, thank the scientists for IVF, because, you know, it is a lifesaver for many that would otherwise not have it. But it cannot be your first choice. And to prioritize having, you know, building a family, like you say, you know, the time it takes to have a baby, you know, so much time is wasted. And I also bring this back to, like, you know, when you get married and you're like, oh, I've got to get married first and have a baby. And, you know, yes, that there are a lot of reasons for that, I guess. It's less favorable these days, but, you know, should someone be traditional and get married, it's like, oh, I can't get pregnant while I'm walking down. I can't be pregnant while I'm walking down the aisle. So I'm going to put off getting pregnant till after I'm married. Then they spend a whole year or more sometimes planning, you know, the bridesmaid shoes, matching the dresses, and this matching the napkins, and all this time, effort, money goes into one day. Meanwhile, that's 2 years of their fertility gone. I mean, if I can give one bit of advice to newly engaged girls, is drag him to the registry office, sign some paperwork, and get started with the babies. Like, you know, don't put it off.
Kat, it's been fascinating listening to you. For people that want to find out more about the work that you do and find out more about, you know, boosting their natural fertility, where can they find you online?
So my website is called Birds and Bees Natural Fertility. So you can Google that, or you can Google Fertility Naturopath Birds and Bees, and you'll find me that way. But I'm sure you'll link to me below.
Yeah, I'll make sure that all the links are in the show notes.
Thank you. I also offer a complimentary call if you're unsure about your situation and which way you should go with it, whether you wanted to work with me or not. So that's also open to people. I've also got a free guide on my website, which is all about fertility testing, all about timing for conception, so you can learn about your menstrual cycle, and all about supplements as well. So there's that free guide if you want to download that from my website, which is birdsandbees.co.uk.
That's fabulous. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Kat Boyd.
Thank you for tuning in to Wisdom Rebellion. Come and join the conversation on our YouTube channel and socials. The links are in the show notes. And don't forget to follow, rate, and subscribe to the show so we can all build a wiser world together.